All right, good morning. Welcome to the start of week two of Computer Science 50. Okay. Yes, sectioning is essentially been done. We're working out these final logistics. We've ramped ourselves up in terms of personnel, so we're now able to offer 23 different sections into which you've all been assigned. That brings us up to 21 teaching fellows as well. So we've got quite the support infrastructure in place for you. I thought we'd begin today with a look at something that's a little trendy. So, out of curiosity, we know at least one of you has an iPhone, since it was left here the other day. Do any of you others still have iPhones? Anyone? No? Just, okay, so a couple of you have iPhones, and even if you don't have an iPhone, odds are you've probably seen one with a friend, or you've certainly heard about it. So, one of the interesting issues commercially with the iPhone has been, as you may know, that it's locked onto AT&T's network. So even though these are GSM phones, which means they take SIM cards, you can't put in a T-Mobile SIM card or a European SIM card into these phones. It should only work with AT&T. For a variety of reasons, people have wanted to circumvent this locking down of the AT&T technology, and so recently released in a few different forms is this so-called unlocking code. So a bunch of real hackers, so to speak, figured out a way to take advantage of what I believe was a quote-unquote buffer overflow exploit within the iPhone, which is something we'll come back to this Wednesday or Friday, actually, such that by taking advantage of a mistake someone presumably at Apple made, a bug in their software, they were able to essentially unlock the phones and allow you to put in, say, a T-Mobile SIM card. Software works. So a friend of mine actually did this, and I lent him my T-Mobile SIM card. He put it in his AT&T phone, and bam, he made a call as though he were me. So it does work until a couple days ago when Apple released a software update for the iPhone, which either bricked, so to speak, which means rendered disabled some of those phones, or at least put them back on the AT&T's network. But odds are the way things go in this world with technology and hackers, someone will figure out yet another way around it. However, you have the source code for the first version of the software that did, in fact, unlock all of the world's iPhones for those people that went ahead and ran it. And the point of this is to show you that, first and foremost, it's written in what language, this program? All right, so this is C, and the top of the file, which I've pulled up here, starts with a big comment, some of which is perhaps inappropriate to discuss in class. You see at the top, though, that there's some familiar features, and the point of this is just to give you a glimpse at, granted, a much more complicated piece of software than ones you've written thus far, but by term's end, you'll certainly be writing programs more along these lines, and what we'll see here in the next 60 seconds is a few pieces of syntax that are familiar and a few pieces that aren't, but by term's end, all of them will look familiar to you. So at the top of the file here, we have all of these includes, and what that's doing is including a whole bunch of what? Libraries. And libraries is something we'll come back to on Wednesday when we look specifically at CS50's library. Scrolling down, we have these sharp define statements. These are what are known as constants. They just declare values that remain constant throughout the file. Scrolling down, we have this thing called a struct early on. That's a data structure that's been defined by whoever wrote the software, and we'll look at how you can implement your own structures and really define your own types of variables in the weeks to come. Here we have what's called a global variable, and this is a topic we'll look at today or on Wednesday, which allows you to declare a variable that any function can access, because you don't put it inside a function, but outside of all of your functions. Here is one of these things known as a function, and we'll spend more time on this today. It's a little cryptic looking on first glance, but here's something somewhat familiar. fprintf is much like printf, except it's for file printing. So you can write to a file with this function. Here's obviously a loop. Here's an if-else construct, which is familiar. Here's another loop. Here's an assignment. So in short, there's a lot of stuff going on in this file, yes, but it all reduces to these basic building blocks, many of which you're already familiar with. So if you're curious, and if you're of the hacker edition mind, certainly look over this code, Google around for more information, perhaps a walkthrough of how it works, but just know that it is through software that people are tackling problems. And granted, it's of perhaps questionable ethical or legal or call it what you may value, but or motivation. But the point, though, is that people are able to solve problems by themselves by writing software like this. And the language of choice for a lot of these kinds of problems or hackings that involve hardware do tend to involve the language known as C, because as we'll see, you will get much closer to the hardware, so to speak, with this language. So without further ado, here is a question. It's a good question. How do they plug this code into the iPhone? There's a 19-step PDF that my friend sent me along with this source code, which I will happily forward along, but essentially it reduces to connecting the phone to, say, a laptop or desktop computer with like a USB cable, or you can do this over the network in theory and just uploading this software once compiled to the iPhone and then executing it. So you can, in fact, get the equivalent of like a secure CRT terminal window on your iPhone because, again, realize that these phones that most of us are carrying around these days, they're not so much phones anymore as they are computers that happen to make phone calls. And so it's very similar in spirit to how you're running software. It's just on a much smaller device. But email me if you want more information. Other questions? All right, here's a message for you. It is encrypted. That is scrambled. What does it say? Excellent. Be sure to drink your Ovaltine. So this is an example of what's known as a cipher, a simple cipher, but a cipher is an algorithm, a procedure that takes some input text and produces some output text. The input is called plain text, the output is called ciphertext, and the purpose of a cipher is to scramble, to hide what the actual content of the message is. So this is an instance of a cipher, a simple cipher called ROT13, for rotate 13. Those of you who didn't quite follow along at home quite as quickly, all that's happened here is that the original message, be sure to drink your Ovaltine, has its letters rotated, so to speak, 13 places. So B plus 13 gives you the letter O, and so forth. And that's how we produce this so-called ciphertext. The strange little boy on the screen here that seems otherwise out of context is, of course, Ralphie from the popular film A Christmas Story, which plays ad nauseum around Christmas time for like 24 hours straight. But it was meant to be a hint because this line is actually taken from that movie. Long story short, I think, as I recall, and I do seem to catch this movie on TNT every year at some point during that 24 hours, Ralphie saves up for like weeks or months for all these like cereal box tops because he's desperate to decode these secret messages, I think, that have been on the backs of these cereal boxes. And finally, when he's accumulated enough coupon codes or whatever they were, he sent in a mail a secret decoder ring from Little Orphan Annie, or Radio Orphan Annie, a popular radio show at the time. And this decoder ring essentially allows you to rotate letters of the alphabet in left and right directions, line them up with each other in such a way that it tells you or tells Ralphie what the secret message was. And he was quite pissed off in the movie to discover that the secret message that had been propagated over all these weeks was but an advertisement by Ovaltine, the program sponsor at the time. So more on that on Friday when we introduce cryptography and the art of concealing data and introduce in that domain problem set 2, which will challenge you to implement a handful of ciphers on your own so that you can write your own encrypted ciphertext. All right, so we've spent the first week of this course on Scratch, we spent the second week of this course on C, and we'll continue to dabble in C largely throughout this course, but what we wanted to make clear to you was this, that though we're focusing for much of the course on C, this course isn't about so much teaching you C, but about teaching you computer science and teaching you programming. And this is, of course, our language of choice because it allows us to introduce a whole great number of topics. But most of the ideas we introduce in this course translate perfectly well to, say, any number of other popular or even less popular languages. So case in point, even with most of the syntax we've looked at thus far, if I wanted to write a program called Hello World in C++, which is a popular language you've probably at least heard of. Turns out that I just want to start this file with include, something called IOStream, which is a library, int main, int argc, charg star, argv, brackets, down here. And then when I want to print out hello world, cout, hello world, and then finally another one of these doubled angle brackets, end L, and then up here I usually have to type something like using standard namespace. But that's it. Assuming I made no errors of syntax, this is a C++ program, which is now in a file called hello.cc. If I go ahead and run not GCC, but G++, which is a C++ compiler, on this file, hello.cc, I should get back some errors. Let's see, expected nested using name, oh, that's got it backwards. So using namespace standard, let's save that again. Let's quit, yep. Quit, save, recompile with G++, and there we go. It produces again a file a.out and hello world. So your first program in C++. And included in today's source code is a whole bunch of other trivial examples of other languages. This is the equivalent program in Java. The syntax, sure, looks a little different, but again, at least structurally, it does tend to be the same. And ifs and loops and elses all tend to look similar. If you want to see something in Perl, this .pl file is an equivalent program for Hello World in the language known as Perl. And this isn't even the only way you can implement Hello World in Perl. It's just one choice of syntax. Here's another one in a language known as Common Lisp, similar to Scheme and other languages of a similar flavor. This is actually the kind of language you'll use in CS51. And this trivial little example, by no means does it good service, given that all I have is a parenthesis, print hello world, close quote, close parenthesis. There's a lot more to Lisp, say, than that. But in fact, a lot of it is about parentheses. So if you've ever seen a crazy looking language that is all about nested parentheses, odds are it's Scheme or Lisp, or something to that effect. Finally, here's a version of Hello World in PHP. Also pretty trivial, doesn't certainly capture how much you can do with PHP, but toward course's end, we'll delve much more into this language known as PHP. And here's the thing. So when I took a course, this course, and CS50, the languages that they taught at the time were C and a bit of assembly language, which we'll also do in CS50. Then in CS51, we looked at C++ and Lisp, Common Lisp, and I think that was about it, maybe a bit more assembly language. And essentially, after those two classes alone, I and all of my classmates, if they continued along the lines of programming, bootstrapped ourselves, so to speak, and taught ourselves these other languages. Perl, for instance, I picked up because at the time I was volunteering for the freshman intramural sports program. We needed a website, and long story short, you don't really implement websites in C or C++, so I taught myself Perl by asking friends and looking at a book and looking at online resources. PHP, I only picked up a couple years ago because Perl has rather fallen out of vogue for web-based software development. PHP and other languages are much sexier these days, and so I picked it up by just reading the manual online and asking questions of friends. And the point here is not to rattle off the languages that I and, say, the teaching fellows know, but rather with a foundation, with a course like this, you go and pick up whatever else you need after a course like this. Whether even if you stop after CS50, typically a student will get enough out of a course like this such that you can go, again, bootstrap yourselves to other languages as your problem domains may see fit. So, without further ado, let's take a look at some more C, some syntax, some problems, and see where we go with this. So I thought we'd start with a little bit of a warm-up. You've seen this picture before. In our first lecture, it was an allusion to what is often referred to as, but might historically not actually be, the first known computer bug. So this is a piece of notebook paper by a woman named Grace Hopper, who used to work on the Harvard's Mark 1 and 2, I believe, systems. And as legend would have it, one day she pulled out of the malfunctioning Mark computer that at the time was at Harvard University's campus the source of a problem. And that problem was a dead moth. And by pulling out this moth, she debugged the first computer. If you look up on Wikipedia and Google, there's many different versions of this story, but this is the one that sort of plays well, even if it is a bit inaccurate. But this is often where we say the term bugs and debugging come from. We're going to use it as a segue to this first example in this file called buggy1.c. And I will try to take care, anytime I intentionally write code that's broken, I'll try to name the file appropriately. In that previous example, hello.cc was not meant to be broken, hence it was called hello. Buggy1 is meant to be broken. This program is supposed to print 10 asterisks, but it doesn't. Why not? Missing bracket. Brackets, what do you mean? Okay, so fair point. So it looks like we are missing the squiggly braces around the for loop, either say here and down here. But recall that it doesn't matter if you only have one statement being executed. If you only have one statement in the loop, you can actually cut corners and avoid having those squigglies. Good. So subtle point, but this in fact is wrong because it prints not 10 asterisks, but rather 11. Why? Yeah, so remember that computer scientists, programmers typically start counting at zero, although in many contexts that's not necessary, it's just convention. But if you are going to start counting at zero, you can't iterate from zero all the way up to and including 10. The convention for a loop like this would be to actually just say less than 10, but there's a more clear way, certainly for those of you still acclimating to starting numbers with zero. This is now correct. How else could we obviously have implemented this loop? Yep.
Going from 1 to less than or equal to 10.
Yeah, if it helps you think about it, by all means, go ahead and say iterate from 1 to 10. You can't get away with this always, especially as we introduce what are called arrays this week, because you're going to start breaking things if you don't think like a programmer, counting from 0 onward. But for the most part, that was just an error of logic. The syntax was fine, the program would work, but as you know, it would in fact print 11 instead of 10 asterisks. How about buggy 2? This program is now supposed to print 10 of those stars as well, one per line. That was my intention when writing this code, but apparently it doesn't print one star per line. Well, first of all, what is this program going to look like? Well, let's just quickly compile GCC, buggy2.c. That gives us a.out. I'm going to go ahead and run it. And clearly, don't worry about how many there are, they're not all on the same line, or they're not all on separate lines. Why? Yeah. Okay. Good. So our first answer is actually applicable to this version. So yeah, we're missing the brackets. So this case, even though I did indent, sort of conveying the idea of what I wanted, that's not sufficient. All of this white space is really for humans and, say, teaching fellows benefit for readability. If you rather want to associate multiple statements with a for loop, it's in this context where you do need those braces. So now if I go ahead, recompile this thing, rerun it, now in fact we have our stars on separate lines. Okay, so any questions on what were, say, just these warm-up questions there?
No.
Okay, so we used this word a couple lectures ago when we were looking at printf format strings, and I used the word casting. And at the time, I think we so-called casted an int to a float so that we wouldn't throw away some degree of precision. Well, it turns out that you can cast not just floats to ints and ints to floats, but also some other data types to each other. So recall from, I think, lecture, the very first or very second lecture in this course, we had a demonstration or a visualization of what was called ASCII, which was that big chart that just mapped letters of the alphabet and other punctuation and such to actual numbers. Well, we can see that is in fact very much the case in C, that numbers ultimately represent characters by way of some of these examples. If at top you want to convert what is ultimately a char to an int so as to figure out what number is underneath the hood representing that char, in this case A, you can simply cast the char, so to speak, typecast the char to an int with syntax like the top line. If you want to go in the reverse direction and you've got on hand the number 65 and you want to transform that into its character equivalent, we'll just cast it explicitly by putting in parentheses the name of the data type you want to cast it to in parens and make the assignment. Let's take a look at ASCII1.c. So without looking at the comments, you do have printouts of this for reference, but without looking at the comments at the very top of the file, take a look at just the three blocks of code here. So that first block of code says display mapping for uppercase letters. Well, make that more real. What exactly am I doing with this loop, even in layman's terms? What is that loop doing? Yeah, see a hand going up? Sure. Okay. Okay, good. So for all uppercase letters, it goes through all of them and prints both the character and the number that corresponds to it. Well, how is this working? Well, one, you know, we demanded that you remember, if nothing else, at least one number a while back, and that was 65 represents capital A. Well, I'm going to start iterating from an int equaling 65. Now, I don't like doing math and 65 plus 26. Let the computer do it. So I want to do this thing 26 times. The compiler will deal with the math for me in this case, though this is arguably silly to do it this way, but it's explicit at least. So I is going to iterate while, this loop is going to iterate while I is less than 65 plus 26, the idea being we want to go from A to Z. On each iteration, we're doing I++, which is the unary incrementation operator. That's the update that happens at the end of each iteration. And then as you note, what are we printing? Well, we're printing out some char, followed by some int, and then a new line. Well, the int, or rather, the, look at that, it's backwards. It still works, but let's go ahead and fix this so that the instruction makes sense. So this is meant to be here. though because typecasting exists, we actually don't need to be so specific. Notice that I'm first outputting not just I, but rather the character equivalent of I with this newly inserted typecast, and then I'm just printing I. So this just maps characters to their numbers. Now I print a line break. What does this do down here? Well, as the comment suggests, it does the exact same thing, but this time using lowercase letters, which just because I paid attention the first week of class, I knew that lowercase a was 97, so I started there. When I go ahead now and compile this thing, I'll go ahead and run GCC of ASCII 1. That gives me a.out, which I'll go ahead and run. And though it scrolls off the screen, we now have that same mapping that you saw on a big PowerPoint slide a while back. Well, how else might we do this? Well, take a look at this version of it. ASCII2.cc, same idea, but implemented a little differently this time. And the screen I've blown up so that the font is bigger, so it wraps off on the screen a little bit. But take a notice of what I'm doing here. I'm iterating again from 65 up to the 26th letter of the alphabet. And then I've got this longer printf line. So let's just take a look at the result. ASCII 2. I've got a.out now. I'm going to run it. And now all I have is this sort of two-column formatting. Okay, not terribly interesting in that we've done it this way, that we've done anything different, but rather, notice that we've just made use of some more interesting formatting strings. Why did I do this with 3? What does that do? Yeah. So recall early on when we talked about precision and width, there was just this aspect to this program that looks like this, whereby once you start getting up into the larger lowercase letters, the ones with larger ints, the numbers start to take up 3 places. And just because I wanted to be anal and I wanted everything to line up perfectly, I wanted to make sure that every number actually took up 3 spaces instead of just its default, which might be 2 or it might be 3. So just by using these printf strings, these formatting strings, can I exercise a bit of control, but otherwise implement the same program, but in a multiple column format. Well, let's take a look at one other variant of this in ASCII3.c. All right. What's going on here, apparently? Yeah. Yeah, so it's the same idea, but this time I'm iterating over the letters themselves, which intuitively might be a little crazy, but again, because underneath the hood, characters are just numbers, and because C allows you to do both explicit casting, like I've been doing with parentheses, but also implicit casting, which is just it figures it out from context, whether to show the char or the int, here I can initialize not an int I, but a char C, to be the capital letter A. I can then say do the following while the variable C is less than or equal to capital Z. And then I can print out each line, which is again just the character followed by its int. And the only thing that's a little crazy now in this example is the update. What is the update doing exactly? Just to be explicit about things. So there's a lot of parentheses, but just like arithmetic, sort of hone in on the most innermost parentheses. Yeah? Yeah, so ultimately it just increments C to the next character. And how does it do that? Well, notice whatever the value of C is currently, it gets casted to an int, so it's a number. Then we add 1, but the context here is char, so I can then explicitly cast the thing back to a char in this manner, and then we have inside our variable C the next letter of the alphabet. But the point, actually, of the mistake I made a moment ago with ASCII 1 and having the cast out of order by accident, turns out it didn't matter, because the compiler would have figured out that in this context, print an int versus a char, but here, to be clear, is where we're being explicit, because as we proceed to more interesting data types than just ints and chars, but perhaps your own structures, and we introduce ideas like pointers, casting, and this explicit use of casting will become more powerful, but also more dangerous if you don't watch out as to what you're casting to what. Well, let's take a look at one final example in the same spirit called battleship.c. So this program is just meant to be a proof of concept of printing the board game Battleship, which recall each player's got like the letters of the alphabet, I think A through J or so, followed by the numbers 1 through 10. And each round of this game, you call out A2 or B6. And so you essentially have a grid of puzzle pieces there. Well, what this thing prints, just to show you the result, is a little game board like the following. A.out, prints this. So at the top row, I have a bunch of numbers. On the leftmost column, I have a bunch of letters. And then I just used lowercase o's to represent the holes in the board, if you've ever played Battleship. One of the things we will do in problem set 3 is actually challenge you with implementing not Battleship, but the so-called Game of 15, as we promised. And so this idea of using just ASCII art, so to speak, just text-based displays, is actually quite useful, even when implementing the most simple of games. But the question for now is, how do we do it? Well, again, it reduces to some of these basic building blocks. So this part here appears to just print out a new line and then some white space, just so I can line things up. And a lot of this program's creation boiled down to just trial and error, typing something out, compiling it, running it, and seeing if things lined up as I wanted them to. And if not, I went back and changed things. What is this line doing? Yeah, just printing the numbers from 1 to 10. And this time, just to be clear in my own mind, I iterated from 1 up through 10, but I could have done 0 to up to 10. But then what would I have had to change if I changed this loop? Yeah, so print out I plus 1, right? So same, different solution, but the effect is the same. All right, what about here? So I'm looping again. So notice that you can reuse variables in C. So even though I've used it before, I can reinitialize it now to 0 again here. I'm going to do this apparently 10 times. Well, what is this line specifically doing? So it's printing a letter. It's specifically printing a character followed by two spaces, but it's printing, and here's some use of implicit casting, the capital letter A, which is the first row that I want to print with a letter, plus I. Why am I doing this? Yeah, so that it's either A plus 0, which is just going to be A, and so A will print as the first row, or once I becomes 1, it's going to become B, and then C, and then D, all the way up to J, at which point we'll have printed out 10 letters. Meanwhile, notice this. So I don't think we've seen this in a C example before, but many of you did this with your Scratch programs. You can certainly have nested loops. So if you want one loop to be inside of another, just take care usually to use these curly braces so that everything's wrapped up tight. And then here, notice that I've got another variable called J, and I did declare it separately up here. J is going to iterate from 1 to 10 as well. We're going to increment J on each pass, and then I'm just going to print these silly little holes in the game board. So the end result, again, is just that it looks like this. So a few new ideas, at least if you've not programmed before, the idea of nesting these loops together, using using variables multiple times, and just generally laying things out in an aesthetically interesting way. Okay. Any questions about syntax or anything related to these ASCII-related problems? All right, so let's take things up a notch. So how could you not like an example that has Homer Simpson somehow involved? So here's that really annoying song that kids would sing on a bus. The point is that it's incredibly cyclical. 99 bottles of beer on the wall just goes over and over and over again. But what's interesting about it, and dare say relevant today, is that there's clearly a looping process going on here and an update to a variable. You first have 99 bottles, then 98, then 97, all the way down to, say, 1 or 0. Well, let's take a look how we might implement a program like this. In beer 1, .c, we have the following. That's the act of someone leaning against the switch and back. So in beer1.c, lecture wall in the closet there. So beer1.c, we first ask, how many bottles of beer will there be? So we don't want to hard code into this program the number 99, just because it would be a very tedious example. We're going to use the CS50 library and call getInt and store that number in n. What am I doing in the lines after I get this int? Yeah, so if the number's not positive, or it's not 1 or greater, it just doesn't make sense, the execution of this program, so we're just going to bail out. We're going to tell the user with this printf statement, sorry, that makes no sense, and then I'm going to return 1. And this is a new piece of syntax. So typically the convention with a C program is that when you want to exit from the main function, we've been doing nothing. We just let the program end thus far. But better practice is actually to return values. By convention, typically you want to return the number 0 when everything goes okay in your main function. That just means exit with success. Under any other circumstances, you want to return either a negative value or a positive value, a so-called error code. If any of you on your PCs or Macs have ever seen some cryptic-looking error message, like error number 39, This is one foolish programming on someone's part because that's meaningless to the user, but probably helpful to the programmer because when you see these weird error codes that your own software is exiting with, it usually means that a programmer has just said, if this error condition occurs, return negative 39. And the program just happens to display that information, irrelevant as it may be, to the user. But by convention, you would typically use a different number to represent a different type of error. This is just a good habit to get into. But let's dive into the song itself. This is clearly a cycle going again and again. So how might we print this? Well, notice that one, you don't have to loop from zero on up. You can loop from some number on down. The syntax is the same. So how many times is this big for loop here going to execute? Yeah, still n times, but just for my own sanity, I wanted to go from, say, 99 on down rather than 0 on to up to 99 and then reverse things by subtracting somewhere by 99. Right? This is just easier to think about. And now notice the song reduces to 4 lines, and the only interesting one now is this last one. So this last one, I simply subtract off 1. And notice, what is the last phrase of this song going to be? Are we going to end with 0 bottles of beer or 1 bottle of beer? So, okay, I heard both answers finally. Okay, I heard both answers again. So which one is it?
It's
so,
0.
Okay, all right. Okay, it's 0. So it is, in fact, 0, because the loop itself iterates all the way down to 0, but then it does stop when I becomes 0, which means the contents of the loop never execute during that iteration, but they do execute while I is still 1. Well, if I is still 1 and the last line of this song is to print I minus 1, it will in fact print 0 bottles of beer on the wall at the very end. So what does this thing look like? GCC of beer1.c. All right, what's this bug mean? Problem of syntax? All right, so this is just that libcs50. Issue because the getInt method function, recall, is in our own library. Let's run a.out. How many bottles will there be?
99.
Okay, 99. Fortunately, it prints fast, and the whole song does, in fact, print out correctly. And we could, just to see it, say, on one screenful, if we do 2, it also does print correctly and just spaces things out. All right, so the interesting thing, though, about this program is that it's a prime candidate for what's called hierarchical decomposition. And this is a really big way of saying, just sort of factor out the conceptually distinct units of your code. Okay, that was actually a pretty big way of saying the same thing too. What it means is, break down a bigger problem into multiple smaller problems. So notice that this loop here that's printing the song could very nicely be factored out conceptually into a function of its own. A function that's maybe called chorus, whose sole purpose in life when called is to just print out the song for a given value of n. Well, we can see this exact idea in beer3.c. So we'll skip over beer2.c for now, which is simply the same thing as 1, but it uses a while loop instead of a for loop, if you're curious as to how you might do it otherwise. Oh, and actually, yeah, let's skip not to 3, but let's take a look at 4. Yeah. So in 4, beer4.c, the top of the code is the same. I get the int, I check its value, and then I proceed to call this while loop. So this is another interesting use or different use of syntax. So n is initialized to whatever int the user has typed in. And now I'm doing this sort of clever trick with just 2 lines. I'm saying do this while n is what? There's no Boolean expression there per se. So what's going on there? While n. Yeah, so not even bigger than 0, while n is not equal to 0. So essentially, recall that a Boolean expression has to be either true or false. Well, it's false if it equals 0. Thus far, we've been saying it's true if it equals 1. But it turns out in most contexts, a Boolean variable or Boolean expression is true if it's anything other than 0. So if n actually equals 6, well, then that is true because it's not 0, and so the loop will execute. If it's 5, still true, it will execute, and so forth. Only once n equals 0 will that loop actually stop. So what we appear to be doing is iterating with this while loop some n times, because on each iteration of this loop, we're calling this function. And this certainly isn't a function that is built into C, but rather one that we implemented ourselves. So thus far, we've pretty much implemented all of these examples in just a main function. And for problem set one, that's probably fine to implement your entirety of your programs in just single main methods, main functions. You don't have to have hierarchical decomposition so much for problem set one unless you feel it's appropriate. But you can do so very easily. So here we have a function. It's again, as promised, called chorus. Notice it's going to take a variable called b, an integer. And what this means is we can now influence the behavior of this function called chorus by passing it a variable, that is, passing it an argument. And notice that we type void up there for reasons we'll come back to. But really, this just means that chorus doesn't return a value. And by contrast, we have seen at least one function last time that did return some value that we assigned to a variable. For now, this does nothing other than have a side effect, printing something to the screen. Well, what's going on? Ignore this stuff at top and just focus on this. This code is pretty much exactly the same as it was before. But this time, rather than printing n, which recall is the variable that's in main, rather we're printing b, which is the argument that's been passed to this method. Well, where does b get its value? It gets its value every time this loop calls, aka invokes, this function called chorus. And we'll ignore the minus minus for just a moment. But as you might have guessed, that's what's doing the decrementation. So the first time we call this thing, n is initialized to 99 in the case we walked through a moment ago. That 99 is passed to the chorus function, so it gets assigned to the variable b. So now at this point in the story, b equals 99. We'll ignore this for just a moment. What happens next? Well, the song just gets printed, this time using b rather than n. But there was a refinement I made here. Just to be anal, I was a little annoyed that the song was grammatically incorrect before. So if you recall, if we ran this with just a.out, and let's say there'll be three bottles of beer, notice that I sort of punted on this issue. And rather than deal with proper grammar, I just parenthesized the letter S so that the thing works for all possible cases, including one bottle of beer, where I should obviously be saying one bottle instead of one bottles. And so I just kind of punted and parenthesized it to say, well, it's correct no matter what the number is. Well, that's not really good programming, and we certainly have the capability to fix this. Well, intuitively, what kind of programming construct would you deploy if most of the time you want to print out bottles, but occasionally, in the case of n equaling 1, you want to print bottle? Yeah, so it's just an if-else, right? If n does not equal 1, you want to print out bottles. Else, you want to print out bottle in the case of just one. Well, it turns out, and here's a new piece of syntax, you can do this in sort of a clever one-liner. So one approach here, again, would be to say if b equals 1, we want to have the effect of printing out, let's say, s1 equals bottle. Else, we want to assign this variable, which is a string variable, the word bottles. So this would be the most obvious way of doing this. But just to introduce a piece of new syntax, what we can do is as follows. One, notice that I'm declaring two strings because I need two different words. Three of these verses use the plural form when bottles of beer on the wall equal 1. But then that last one does change because it decrements. So we have two different words. One's going to be plural, and one's going to be plural or singular, depending on the context. Well, what I do is this. S1 is going to get assigned one of two values, either bottle or bottles. And the way this syntax works is that this one-liner is equivalent to an if-else. This just means S1 gets either bottle, if this is true, else it gets this value. So this is the equivalent of the if, and what follows the colon is the equivalent of the else. And you can nest these things, but they get very ugly and very confusing quickly. And so typically, one will just use them in an if-else equivalent form like this. And meanwhile, S2 is going to get assigned the value bottle or bottles, depending on the value of B, but this time if it equals 2. Now, let's see what the end result here is. So this, again, was beer 4, so GCC of beer 4.c. Okay, again, we have that problem with the library, so we have to include it. And now if I run a.out, I'm going to say 99 bottles of beer on the wall. And now notice the song is correct. And I've gotten rid of the parentheses. I took away the shortcut that I made. And now grammatically, the song is correct. And again, just a different way of actually doing this with some new syntax. Okay. Any questions on this? All right, so let's turn back to that one piece of code that we waved our hand at. How is this while loop actually working? Well, we focused on what's inside the parentheses next to the while. So while n is not equal to 0, it's going to execute again and again and again. I mean, you can kind of take a guess now how this thing works. What is n minus minus doing in this context? Yeah, exactly. We've seen this syntax before, i++ or i- in our loops. You can use it in other contexts as well. Chorus gets invoked with the current value of n. But then when it's done executing, n also gets decremented. So the equivalent of this really would be what? If I wanted to make this explicit and I find this syntax confusing, what do I need to change here to do the equivalent but make it more clear? Yeah, exactly. And if even that's sort of too ambiguous for me at this point, well, that just equals n gets n minus 1. So the exact same idea. Okay, so any questions on beer 1 or 4.c? 2 and 3 I'll defer as an at-home exercise. Yeah. So yes, and we'll see other examples of this. If you actually want to control exactly when things are decremented or incremented, it depends sometimes on the context, but there is also a minus minus and a plus plus operator that can come before variables. But we'll see explicit instances of that before long. Okay, other questions? Do you want to make your announcements? Yeah? Okay, so let's do this. Let me re-announce that CS50 this semester has this partnership of sorts with the Harvard Computer Society, a student group on campus, and among other things, they have very generously offered up some of their time this semester. Some of your most savvy computer type students on campus will be giving a number of seminars for us this semester, and let me introduce Josh Kroll to give you some specifics, as well as Ted, one of our own CS50 students, who oddly enough will be giving these seminars as well. So.
Hi guys, I'm Josh. I'm the director of systems for the Harvard Computer Society, and I guess some of you probably know he's our treasurer. We'll be getting some seminars this semester on some topics. First one will be this week, this Wednesday actually, on how to use Unix and Linux, sort of beyond just really basic commands like listing directories, changing directories, and so forth. So we'll be giving two sections of those this Wednesday, one at 1 and one at 7 p.m. Those will be in the Science Center Mac Computer Lab, which is on the second floor. I think it's 229. Just out of curiosity, how many of you think about one of those sessions? Okay, very good. If you could send an email to cs50plusrsvp@fs.harvard.edu, not so much that you know you have to RSVP to come, but more so that you have a rough idea of how many people we're expecting. And later in the semester, also, we'll be doing some seminars on PHP, and hopefully then that will make your final project easier if you just use in PHP. I want to talk briefly about the club, though. We do a lot of things on campus. We really are interested in and are a good place if you want to come join us. People who are interested in technology is applications in society. We provide some services to student groups. We provide the ability to create mailing lists and websites for students and student groups. We also have various events, bring in speakers. We have office hours once a week on Wednesdays from 8 to 10 in Hillis 307, so you can feel free to join us if you're interested in coming. Professor Malin actually is an alumnus of HCS, so I'll have to join us, and I hope to join us on Wednesday for the seminars as well.
Why don't we end on the note of Homer Simpson and that note, and we'll see you on Wednesday.